No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in with any questions at 888-627-6008. We have a very interesting guest for you tonight. But before we start, let me just say hello, Maria. How are things in California?
Hello, Senator. Things are terrific. We've had the most outstanding weather, and we are in a drought again, so there's a price to be paid for that. How about the District of Columbia?
We're doing okay, and it's an important week for us because we're going to have a hearing on our bill, and we'll talk about that during the show. But before I introduce our guests, let me just say that our condolences go out to the family of Janet Brown. Janet was a statehood advocate for more than 40 years. She and her husband were on our show because they were at the 1963 march on Washington, D.C. And then they went with me to the 50th anniversary of that march. And both Norman and Janet were on the show to talk about that. They both passed now, and our deepest condolences go out to her family. She was an amazing, amazing, amazing person.
Yeah.
And then that being said, let me introduce another amazing, amazing person, Karen Gray Houston. Karen Gray Houston is an award-winning journalist whose career in broadcasting has spanned more than 41 years on television and radio. She retired from Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., the local Fox station, in 2014 after 20 years as a local news reporter. She worked as a radio and TV correspondent for NBC News covering the Reagan White House, was a reporter and an anchor for WTOP Radio here in D.C. and WHDH AM in Boston, and anchored on the ABC Radio Network. She was a writer, associate producer at WCBS-TV in New York, and a reporter, writer, editor at United Press International in Boston. She has been nominated multiple times for Emmy Awards. And believe me, that is just that's just a brief synopsis of who she is, because if I was to read her entire bio, we wouldn't have time to talk to her. It's so extensive.
And anyway, you have to mention author.
And author. Yes, we're about to. That's the main thing. Because she's here tonight to talk about this book that she's written, Daughter of the Boycott. And that's only one thing. Thank God I have Maria. You know, the older I get, you know, I would forget my own name if it weren't for her. But yes, an author of Daughter of the Boycott, carrying on a Montgomery family civil rights legacy. And what a family you come from, Karen. Welcome to our show, and thanks so much for being on.
Wow, Senator. I'm just wondering if you left anything out. Thank you so much.
I left out so much.
Really glowing introduction.
Graduate of Columbia University.
Oh, no, he left himself all out.
many things I've left out. But anyway, we can talk about it during the show. Can we start by just having you give our listeners a background about your amazing family, a little background info?
Yes, you can do that. Let's start with my father and my uncle they were both organizers and real leaders of the Montgomery bus boycott. My dad, the late Judge Thomas W. Gray Sr., was an organizer of the boycott. And even before, you know, he was somebody who drove his car and picked up passengers to keep them off the buses to make the bus boycott a success. You know, they were aiming to get integrated seating on buses in Montgomery back in 1955. But 5 years before that, he also organized a protest against white police brutality. So my book and my story is resonating a lot these days because it's something that happened 71 years ago. My uncle, Fred Gray, is a renowned civil rights attorney. His first big case desegregated buses in Montgomery, went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which found segregated seating on buses unconstitutional. But he has had an extraordinary career as a civil rights attorney. He has been involved in cases that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. He's actually argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. And a lot of those cases about voting rights and integrating malice and he got the federal troop protection for the marchers from Selma to Montgomery during that march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. His cases are fodder for conversation in law schools around the country, constitutional law classes. And he's still current. But so that's my father and my uncle. And those are two people who I really wanted to pay homage to when I wrote this book.
Well, after reading about them, there are two people that we should all pay homage to. Mm-hmm. They really have done extraordinary things. And let's talk for a moment about something that I found just incredible, that they want to rename a street in honor of your uncle, but they can't do it because there's a law in Alabama that says you can't take a Confederate, you can't change a Confederate memorial. Is that true?
Yeah, they call it the Alabama Memorial Preservation Act. Seriously? Basically, the street that my dad and my uncle grew up on was called West Jeff Davis in Montgomery, okay? Nobody really thought about it back in the day when they were growing up. It was just a street name that they just happened to live on it. And, you know, as a matter of fact, that part of the street where they used to live doesn't even exist anymore because it's been torn down during urban renewal. It was torn down and a big highway came through that area. So it's not even there anymore. But the rest of the street exists, and the new African-American mayor, Stephen Reed, wanted to honor my uncle for all these things he's done. And he looked around and he saw, you know, memorials in Montgomery, the Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, and a civil rights activist, E.D. Nixon, nothing about Fred Gray. So he decided he's going to rename the street and made a big announcement and renamed the street. It's going to be Fred D. Gray Avenue. And at one point, it's going to intersect with Rosa Parks Avenue, right, in the same neighborhood. And then there was the problem of this 2017 law that was brought to everyone's attention that says that you cannot deface, rename, or, you know, destroy a monument that was constructed to honor a person or event or group or movement or military service. And we know what that means, right?
Yeah.
Any monuments to the Confederacy cannot be changed. If you do violate the law, there's a $25,000 fine. And after the mayor announced that he wanted to rename the street, somebody made, proposed a law in the state house, in the state legislature, to increase the fine to $10,000 a day for every day of the violation. Well, that didn't make it through the legislature, but there's still that $25,000 fine. And so now we're all waiting to find out what's going to happen. The mayor, Mayor Reed, is basically saying, I'm going to move forward with this, which sounds like he's going to have to find $25,000 somewhere to pay this fine if crazy people down there decide that they're going to impose it for changing the name of that street to, in a black community, right? It was a really poor neighborhood in Montgomery, named after this Confederate president.
Well, I'm sure that would be an instant hit on a GoFundMe page.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
I mean, people from California would donate to that, let alone wherever. I wouldn't hope that the fine would be anything that would stop anyone from doing that. Do you think it is, Karen?
I think it's going to happen. It's just a matter of, they got to go through motions. They got to talk to the county commission about,
planning.
Steps you have to take. They got to do that stuff. But I think it will happen. And, it just brings up the larger issue of, there's about close to 2,000 Confederate monuments and symbols around the country, and they're being torn down and toppled and renamed and desecrated and all of that. It brings up the question of what should we be doing with these things? Mm-hmm. Do they belong in a museum? Should they be destroyed? What should happen to them?
Well, somebody's got to tell
the person who's going to tell you. Go ahead, Michael.
I'm just saying somebody's got to tell those people down there that they lost that war. Because there's a lot of people that in Alabama that don't understand that. I told you when we talked, Karen, that I had family that lived in Montgomery for a while. I spent some time down there 35 years ago when my brother was stationed at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery. And I'm telling you, the difference between black people in Washington, D.C. and black people in Alabama in those days was you recognized it immediately, that they didn't feel the same way Washingtonians did. You could see that they were still, I remember service people that wouldn't look you directly in the eye and all sorts of other behavior that struck me as very conciliatory and very
deferential.
Deferential, yes. And it's a
different
thing. I hope it's changed. Yes, it is. It's different.
Yes. It's changing, but back in the 50s, people would walk down the street and turn the other way, look aside, step aside when white people walk by. They got used to the Jim Crow laws that forced the separation of the races, and they were, accustomed to, we eat in a different restaurant, we can't go to the white hotels. Right. We don't go to white churches. We don't go to white schools. It was just, it really was a way of life. And when you hear white people talking about a way of life, that's what they're talking about. A way of life that they liked before that's gone away. And some of them want it to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And these monuments, these are monuments to traitors who lost the war. They were not fighting for states' rights. They were Confederate soldiers fighting to hold on to slavery. Forced, violent, unpaid labor by black people to help them control the pot, to help them maintain the cotton field.
Well, that's something that really gets me when I'm working on statehood, D.C. statehood, that I hear people on Capitol Hill, Republicans, saying, this is what the Founding Fathers wanted for D.C. They didn't want D.C. to have the same rights everybody else has. And all I can think is, why in the world are we taking our guidance on the issue of participation from a bunch of white misogynistic slave owners? Are they really the people? Should we really follow their lead? They didn't want women to vote. They didn't want African Americans to vote. They didn't want Native Americans to vote. They didn't want people that fought in the Revolutionary War but didn't own property to vote. So they weren't an inclusive bunch. And right. I know that some people think that every word that came out of their mouth was something holy, but it certainly wasn't. So I'm sorry, Marie. Right. Go ahead.
Part of your history, Karen, that fascinated me, and I hope you'll go into some detail about this, is I cut my teeth on talk radio as a public affairs host first, very, very first, and then went on to a talk radio career. And I know you did public affairs interview programs. Was that during your career, the beginning of your career? And what did that look like? Because not everybody knows what public affairs means anymore, since the FCC has relaxed some of their regulations in that regard.
My public affairs involvement came actually around, I guess, the middle of my career. I started out in radio. Oh, Maria, I have a love of radio. And one of my first jobs was at a radio station in Boston during another crazy period in time when they were desegregating the schools. But aside from, and then I worked as an anchor at the ABC radio network on their FM stations. I was on anchoring ABC radio stations around the country. And I worked at WTOP, all news radio in Washington, D.C. And while I was working at WTOP, I carved out a little niche for myself where I was really covering local politics and what was going on with Mary and Barry and what's happening at City Hall before they called it the Wilson Building, the district building. And so, people kind of noticed, and, stations like Channel 4 and WEPA, and WHUP, and the radio station WAMU would say, hey, we need somebody to come in and talk about local politics. And I would go in and have conversations about what I knew. You know, everybody wants to, you've got your ear to the ground. What's the real skinny? So mm-hmm. I was doing a little of that. And it was, and Maria, you know it, what it's like. It's fun.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. It, well, what people don't understand about radio versus television is there is no safety net. There is no second take. It's live, it's raw, it's real, and especially if news is breaking while you're on the air, you got to quick get with what the story. I was on the air when Princess Diana died, and all of a sudden you're shifting over to what everybody needs to be talking about because you might be the first voice that lets them know what we now know. And so the fact that you could do radio and television, and it looks so glamorous, especially the TV part. And maybe you can share with our listeners how not glamorous it is behind the scenes until you get in front of the camera.
I don't want to tell how really unglamorous it is. Like you're driving, you're out someplace and they call you with breaking news and there's a small plane crash someplace out in the field in the country. And you go out there and there's no bathrooms out there, right? Okay. Well, the guys can go out in the trees in the woods, but where am I going? You know, but people don't think about the little things that happen like that, that you have to deal with. You know, the weather. Okay. It's snowing and somebody's got to tell the people, don't go out in the snow because it's dangerous. Don't go over here. Don't do that. But we're out there, you know, with all our snow duds on and, you know, those little pads that heat up in your toe, that you put in your shoes and your gloves to keep your hands warm. And, you know, that is not glamorous. But, you know, I want to be the person at the place where it happened before everybody else gets there. And then I want to tell everybody what happened. So that was, you know, nosy people like news, and that's who I was.
And be camera ready.
Oh,
yeah.
I want to say this because my husband who worked at Chris Houston used to work, my first husband who passed away a few years back from pancreatic cancer. He worked at Channel 9 and he would stop everything he was doing when the news came on and turn on Channel 5, right, to see what I was doing. And he would go, what did I tell you about the last thing you're supposed to do before you jump in front of the camera? You're supposed to look in a mirror. Don't forget to comb your hair, put on some lipstick and a little powder on your nose. So those are the little things people don't think about that are happening out there in the media world.
Yes, actually, I remember your husband, and I remember that he was a University of Maryland alum. I went to University of Maryland as well. Well, let me ask you about, we want to talk about your book and try to figure out what you found in writing it that is relevant for today. And I'm sure there's a lot, but let me first ask you a question which is on everybody's mind now, and that's vaccinations. Your uncle was it your uncle or your dad that dealt with lawsuits for the people that survived the Tuskegee syphilis experiments? It was your uncle, right?
And it was my uncle, Fred Gray, and everybody didn't survive. The people got they passed syphilis onto their wives and their children. It was unborn children born with syphilis. It was a horrible thing. Fred Gray, there was a lawsuit that never made it into the courtroom. He got a settlement for the survivors. And, you know, it was a multi-million dollar settlement, but that was enough, not enough for all of the egregious, mistreatment that they underwent by not receiving, the penicillin that could have saved them from all of that. And the terrible thing about the government, this was a federal government doctor study that lasted for 40 years when the people wanted to know what happened if somebody had syphilis and they didn't get treatment. So they withheld it. And that, and they found out what happened. Well, my uncle represented them, got the settlement, and a few years later was able to help convince President Bill Clinton that the government, the federal government, owed those people and their families an apology. And Bill Clinton apologized for that. And my uncle and a couple of the older remaining victims, you know, went to the White House. And as a matter of fact, I got to cover that story, which was really special.
Wow.
When he apologized for that. So now here's the upshot of that is right now we've got this horrible virus out here and a lot of people who are not taking the vaccine and they like to point to the Tuskegee study as a way of saying, I'm not going to take it because look what happened then. Well, a lot of them are really not informed about what really happened. And I have talked to people who say they thought that the government doctors injected the people with syphilis, which is not what happened. So they're saying, we don't know what they're injecting us with. Well, that's not what happened. And the study, this is not a study. What's going on now is not a study involving, it was like a secret thing that was happening down there in Macon County, Alabama. That a lot of people didn't know about. Everybody knows about this. And hello, white people are rushing to get in line before the black people. I mean, it does point out that there remain disparities in healthcare in the country because black people are suffering from the virus more and not being able to get as much of the treatment as they need. So there are those disparities. But my uncle has said, wait a minute, and stepped up and is trying to encourage people to go ahead and get the vaccine. He's 90 years old and he and his wife have both gotten both of their shots. Okay. He's fine. He goes to work every day. He still has his law practice. He gets in his car, he drives to the office every day and he practices law. Okay. So, and he's involved. People still want to hear from him about the Montgomery bus boycott and all of his legal cases. And so he's still talking to people about what happened then, accepting honorary doctorate degrees and, you know, lifetime achievement awards. And there is a move afoot to try to get convince President Biden to give him the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Oh, my gosh.
I hope he gets it. I hope he gets it.
I hope he does, too. I hope he does, too. It's exactly... I think it's the type of award that was designed exactly for people like him that have spent a life in advocacy. So I hope he gets it too. You know, when in 1992, I got to meet Rosa Parks. I was working at the Democratic Convention. I was behind stage getting VIPs on the stage and she walked in. And I saw her. I had no idea who she was. And I asked somebody and they told me who she was. And I was surprised. I was surprised that she was so tiny. I was just, there's this little lady with her hair in a bun and big old glasses. And, you know, I don't know. I guess I thought, given all that she had accomplished, that, you know, she'd be 5'10" and, and very imposing looking. How did the Montgomery bus boycott affect you as a little girl? You were a little girl when this happened, 3 or 4 years old.
Right, Michael. I was 4 years old. And, you know, 4-year-olds don't know anything about what's going on in grown folks' world. My parents were actively involved in things while my mother was at home raising me and my 2 younger brothers. My dad, on the other hand, was on the organization that that coordinated the bus boycott, the Montgomery Improvement Association. He's going to meetings with Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and my Uncle Fred and all those people who were trying to figure out a carpool or a massive carpool arrangement so that they could get people to their jobs without having to, you know, get on the buses. So Dad was doing that. He was a businessman. Thomas Gray and my next across the street neighbor, William Singleton, owned a radio, TV, and appliance store where they did service and sales. And Dad liked to brag over the years about how he sold Martin Luther King and Coretta a couple of TV sets and a washing machine when they first moved to town. But so Dad was doing that, and Uncle Fred he was meeting with Rosa Parks every day. My uncle was 24 years old when he got out of law school. What he had to do, okay, here's Uncle Fred's deal. He was a young kid who, and see, I'm getting off the subject of me, but I was looking, Uncle Teddy used to come over to the house, and I called him Uncle Teddy, and I still do. He had some friends who called him Teddy, and I, to this day, call him Uncle Teddy. He used to come over and babysit at our house for us. And bring us ice cream, and so we loved him. But he had this mission. He came back from a religious boarding school where he had become a preacher, but he decided he was looking at how terribly Black people were being treated on the buses and decided that he had to do something about it. And he was also getting some feedback from E.B. Nixon, Mr. Civil Rights, saying Black people aren't going to get anything unless we get some lawyers in town. So he decided he was going to go to a law school that would accept Black people because he couldn't apply in Montgomery. They wouldn't let him in. And he went to Ohio, Western Reserve University, to get his law degree. And he made this promise to himself that he was going to get that degree. He was going to go back to Alabama. He was going to pass the bar. And he was going to destroy everything segregated he could find. And so that's what he did. And in the meantime, my little brothers and I were going to Hope Street Baptist Church Nursery School, you know, where they had the mass meetings. Well, they also mm-hmm. had a little nursery school for little kids. So that's what I was kind of doing. And it wasn't really, I didn't get a sense of that my dad was involved in, you know, I knew that Dad would leave every day in the morning. He'd get in his car, have his green Plymouth, and he'd go, after he's going to work, he would go pick these past people up. He'd go driving around the streets, and eventually he got an assignment where he'd go to this one church and he'd pick people up and drive them wherever they needed to go. And he also had a side gig where he was a radio announcer. Maria, he was a radio announcer in the 50s.
Wow.
And he would play music because, a lot of Black people would listen to the radio in the morning because they wanted to find out where they could go get a taxi or where Martin Luther King and Reverend Ralph Abernathy were going to be at the mass meetings. And so my dad was somebody on the radio talking about these things. So it wasn't really until after the boycott was over that I had a sense at all about it. Because one day my mom got me all dressed up and my two younger brothers, my brother Thomas Jr. and Fred, Frederick, who was named after Fred, and she walked us a block down the street to a bus stop. And we never had been on a bus before because our family had a car. And we always drove places in a car. But my mother wanted us, and we waited for the bus. It was like probably the middle of an afternoon when it wasn't crowded or anything. We got on the bus, and she made sure we sat right up in the front. So we would know what it felt like, little Negro colored children to know what it was like not to have to sit in the back of the bus. So that's kind of my
recollection. And or give up your seat. And I don't know if our listeners know that the boycott lasted for a year, for 12 months. That transportation was vital to the population. And for 90 to 100% of the Black community in Montgomery to choose not to ride a bus, talk about power and walking the walk and talking the talk. And that it took 12 months for it to get all the way up to the Supreme Court for them to say, no, that's against the law. You can't segregate buses.
Okay. Well, here comes the story, Maria. Okay. Michael?
No, I was just going to ask you, before you go on, do you know why Parks did what, for example, Colvin couldn't do?
Those right. Colvin. And Mary Louise Smith. And, they were both arrested before her.
Right.
In 1955.
What was it about Parks? You know, I say this all the time. I met her and I said hello and introduced myself, and that was about it. But I often say, I wish I could talk to her now and say to her, did you have any idea of what you were, you know, the firestorm that you were about to create? What do you think was different, or do you know, about Parks that wasn't, you know, with the others that did the same thing?
Well, just to speak to the chronology, Claudette Colvin was a 15-year-old girl who 9 months before Rosa Parks gave up her seat, did the same thing, refused to get out of her seat. She was a young kid. It was in March of 1955, and she had been in a classroom where they, in February, where they were talking Black History Month, and they were talking about all the injustices and Black people and how they've been being mistreated and this and that and the other, and what their rights were. And she was on the bus in March, and the bus got crowded, and the bus driver told her to get up, and she refused to get up, and she said, it's my constitutional right to sit here, and, you know, and the police came and dragged her off the bus and arrested her. Well, my uncle thought that was the case. This is a perfect test case, you know, and I think he had been in consultation with Thurgood Marshall, and they were saying, this is great, oh, wonderful, this will be the way that we're going to get away from segregation on the buses. But a couple months later, little Claudette turned up pregnant. And so I think there was a feeling amongst many in the community that she was not the face that they wanted to put on their movement to get, you know, integration on the buses. And there were three other women. There was, Aurelia Browder, Susie McDonald, and Mary Louise Smith. Well, Mary Louise was a teenager just like Claudette. And then there was the rumor that Mary Louise's father was an alcoholic, so they didn't want that. And Aurelia Browder was an adult, dark-skinned Black lady with spoke her own mind, too outspoken. And Susie McDonald was a really light-skinned, bright, light lady who looked white, and she used to sit in the front, and it used to piss off the bus drivers because, you know, she was a Black lady.
Right.
Anyway, so it was sort of like it, none of them really fit the mold. And Rosa Parks was an activist who was trying to figure out, we got to do something about this. And she and my uncle had been meeting for lunch. You know, when he came back from law school, he was trying to start a practice, and he became involved in the NAACP. And Rosa Parks was the secretary, and she was also the head of the NAACP's youth council. And E.D. Nixon, they were all talking about, you know, we got to do something about this segregation. And Rosa Parks worked as a seamstress at the department store, which was down the street and around the corner from my uncle's law office. And at lunchtime, she used to go eat lunch with him. Now, and I found out from reading some of her papers later at the Library of Congress that she didn't like to try to eat at the cafeteria, eat at the department store, because they wouldn't let the Black people eat in the cafeteria. The staffers, they had to work, eat in this, even if they worked there, they had to eat in a little place that was behind a bathroom door that wouldn't close. I mean, just disgusting. So she would take her little sandwich or whatever and go up to Fred's office, and they would sit down and talk about, well, what are we going to do? You know, and she would talk about, well, you know, she had had some problems with bus drivers before. And so if she was ever in a situation where, you know, somebody told her to get up, how would she act? They talked about her, what her demeanor should be. I mean, they were planning this. This wasn't a thing where she was just tired on the bus that day.
Right.
Rosa Parks had, prior to that, been a really active person. She was an investigator for the NAACP. In the 1940s, there was a Black woman, Recy Taylor, in Abbeville, Alabama, who was raped by six white men. And she had gone down there to ask questions and get, you know, some information. And the men were acquitted. And Rosa Parks wrote a letter to the governor trying to seek justice, but didn't get it. And so it wasn't as if Rosa Parks was this sweet little old demure seamstress, quiet model. She was angry about, you know, segregation, and she wanted to do something about it. And that day that they arrested her, she was waiting for the opportunity, and she just seized the moment.
Yeah. And what a, yeah. And she seized the moment and she changed the world. You know, I saw a picture of you, Karen, sitting at the Martin Luther King Memorial, which is, I got to greet people when they first opened it. It was a great honor. I met many people who had, sat in it, lunch counters and other things that never expected to see the memorial. But one of the criticisms of the memorial that really struck me as ridiculous was there was an article in the Post one day, that there were a bunch of people that didn't like the memorial because Martin Luther King looked angry. Well, I always thought he was angry. You know, I always thought he was, you know, I don't know what they wanted. I guess they wanted a cartoon, representation of who the man he really was. But, you know, it seems
well,
to me that,
other
that
than
he
his,
was angry.
His arms crossed and the fact that he's not smiling, I would just say he looks powerful to me.
Yeah. And
not angry.
Resolute is right. What I'd say, yes.
I feel the same way, and I was so proud because that day, that picture was taken was the day they dedicated the memorial, and I was just so happy to be there, and so, you know, it's like, oh my God, you know, and my dad knew him, and my uncle, and they worked with him, and look, this is finally happening, but it didn't happen easily. It took a long time to get the money for it, and I remember covering a story one day, I don't remember the year, Sheila Johnson, the owner, at the time was the owner of the Mystic, donated $1 million to the cause to try to encourage other people to make donations so that they would have enough to build the monument on the mall. And it was just a very special thing. It finally happened and I couldn't believe it. So, and I'm happy to have that picture. commemorating the moment.
And I was at the dedication, and two things that I remember that really stand out for me was when John Lewis said, first of all, that he thought it was such an appropriate tribute because the one thing that bothered Dr. King was that he felt that he was short. And that was something that always bothered. And there he is, you know, 35 feet tall. So he said he thought that was appropriate. And also the fact, and this is a, something you talked about earlier, that his parents, Lewis's parents, begged him not to get involved with King. Said, the man's a troublemaker. You're just going to get it. You're going to get in trouble. You know, it's better that we eat in the, as you said, get used to eating in the segregated restaurants and stuff. Stay away from him. He's no good.
And John Lewis had heard Martin Luther King on the radio and was, like many of us, mesmerized by the sound of his voice and the tenor of what he was saying. And he was he wanted to integrate a college, to go to college. So he thought, well, let me write. He wrote a letter to Dr. King. I want to go to, you know, blah, 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 blah. And can you help me get there? And so Martin Luther King sent him a bus ticket. And he came to Montgomery, and my Uncle Fred picked John Lewis up at the airport and took him to, at the airport, at the bus station, and took him to Reverend Abernathy's First Baptist Church, where King was, for the meeting. And they, you know, they were all fast friends after that. But it's kind of unbelievable the way these things all happened, isn't it?
Yes. Well, your family was just at the center of all this, which is just so amazing. And let me just add one thing about John Lewis. Just before he passed, I was on Capitol Hill with my intern who was from Atlanta. And as we passed his office, my intern said, we were there with a group of people. Oh, that's my congressman. And Karen, you know, Karen.
Yes.
Yes. Who runs everything for me. Said, well, let's go in and see if he'll say hello. And we took Teddy in, and Lewis not only said hello, he took Teddy into his office And we all sat there as he talked to Teddy for a half an hour and wanted to know where Teddy was going to school and what was up with Teddy. And, you know, he was such a generous person. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's who he was. And as I recall, every time I saw John Lewis when I was in Montgomery, when I was in D.C. from the time I first started working at, I think when I first started, was at WTOP, because I had worked there at NBC before covering the White House, but I hadn't bumped into him, I don't think, at that time. He would always say, you know, your uncle is the first lawyer I ever met. Your uncle's the first lawyer I ever met. And, you know, well.
Well, he was just, and I should point out that Teddy, by the way, is a white kid. He wasn't a black kid. It didn't matter to John Lewis.
Right.
What John Lewis saw when he looked at him was a kid. Mm-hmm. And he sat there and was generous with his time. I'm sorry, Maria, you go ahead.
I do have two questions, Karen, about Republicans. One is Condoleezza Rice, because she was raised in Birmingham, Alabama. Did your families happen to interact at all with the civil rights movements?
In Birmingham, not really. I mean,
okay.
I know the
so they were separate the girls. Communions.
Yeah, my uncle. You know what? I remember my uncle going to Birmingham once. Is a long story. After the KKK was coming to the neighborhood, because they were angry because Adam Clayton Powell, the congressman from New York, congressman, had come down and was going to give a voting rights speech. And Big Jim Fulton, who was the white governor at the time, wanted to meet with this flamboyant congressperson and invited him to the governor's mansion and gave him access to the governor's limousine that was driven by a black man who lived in my neighborhood. And so when the KKK heard about that, they were upset and asked the governor to either fire the limousine driver or not allow that, you know, him to be chauffeuring this other black man around, because who is that guy and how can that happen and why is this black man coming to the governor's mansion? So the KKK was going to come to our neighborhood, and my dad and a bunch of veterans who lived in World War II vets in the neighborhood they had these watch groups out, and this was a whole long story and too convoluted, and I probably should tell people they should read about it in my book.
Okay. Well, absolutely. Look,
wait a second, though. But I want to ask about your encounters with President Ronald Reagan.
Encounters?
Well, travels. Well, I guess I should say.
I covered the White House. I worked for NBC. I was mainly a radio correspondent, hired to be a radio correspondent. But you know, you get to the White House, there's all this stuff going on, and so they need people to cover news for the affiliated stations. TV station. So I used to do radio and TV, and I got to travel on Air Force One a couple of times. You know, there's a lot of people, reporters working in the White House, and everybody doesn't get to go on Air Force One. You know, the press pool, you know, small group goes on Air Force One, and it travels really closely around the president. The rest of us go on, you know, the bus, the plane that the press plane, you know. You know, I would see him at, you know, state dinners. And then there's a hierarchy at the, you know, there was like seven or eight of us working for NBC at the time. And, you know, everybody doesn't get that diploma assignment. You know, it's sort of like, okay, if it's going to be somebody, is it going to be Judy Woodruff or John Palmer or Andrea Mitchell or Karen Gray Houston? Oh, I was Karen Gray at the time. And so, you know, I didn't get all the plum assignments, but it was exciting to kind of be in the White House. And I'll say it's exciting for about 6 months. And then after that, you go, oh, wait a minute. I just lost my life. I'm working around the clock. I'm working 20 hours a day and on the weekends. And, but you know, at first it's glamorous and exciting. And then after a while, you kind of go, boy, am I tired.
Well, you know, I've got a Ronald Reagan question for you too. I worked for Jimmy Carter, and I worked on Jimmy Carter's reelection campaign, which didn't go so well, if you remember. But the thing that really got us, the thing that really, really annoyed us after Reagan was elected, is how much the press loved him. Because the press was not particularly fond of Jimmy Carter. And I remember the incident that really got to me was he went to the Bitburg Cemetery. I don't know about if you remember this.
I'm sorry, he went where?
He went to the Bitburg Cemetery in Germany to do some sort of speech or something. And Nazis were buried there, Nazi soldiers. So he came under, you know, there were liberals who said, well, he shouldn't go there, you know, because there's SS troops buried there. And he said, he made some off the cuff remark like, oh, Nazi schmatzy or something. And everybody laughed about it. And we just thought, oh my God, if Carter said that, they would have crucified him. So what is it? Well, do you know what it was?
Was it about him?
I'm sorry.
He was a movie star. He had a movie star personality. And he was, when he talked to people, they liked him. He had some kind of charisma that people loved. And, you know, some people were willing to, you know, just kind of, they liked that about him. I personally had issues with the politics and what was happening with, how he wanted things to happen for minorities. And, so I didn't maybe feel the same way. But if I had my druthers, I would take Ronald Reagan over Donald Trump any day.
Oh,
did I say
God.
That out loud?
Yeah. Yes, you did.
God.
And it's fine.
Absolutely. But that was something that always got us, you know, was that they just at the very end, the press didn't like Carter. And I can see, you know, when you're talking about Reagan being a movie star, Carter had just the opposite personality. You know, great, great guy. He's 96 years old and he's still building houses for the poor and teaching Sunday school. But he was very dry
dry,
you know, he was more like a school teacher or a minister, than he was, flamboyant. Let me just ask you, because we're running out of time.
There is a question, though, from a caller for Karen.
Oh, there is? Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, let's take that. But before we take it, let me say that I just bought your book on the Chicago Review Press, and everybody else should do the same if you're out there listening. Is there someplace else they can get it, Karen, or is that the place to go?
You can buy my book wherever books are sold.
Good.
You can buy the book. And also, let me throw in, it's also available as on Kindle and as an audiobook and also as an downloadable for Audible from Audible or as an audio CD if you're not really technologically into the download. And I narrate.
Do you?
I narrate the audiobook.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well,
nice.
Let's take the question. Who's
Samuel from Baltimore.
Samuel, thanks for calling in.
Do you hear me well?
There
yes,
you are.
You.
Hello.
Hi, Samuel.
Good evening, Ms. Houston, and thank you so much for your testimony, for your narrative on this issue of Montgomery. I do have a question for you. Did you cover the struggle in Lebanon back in 1982?
Hello. I'm sorry. That wasn't me.
Okay, I'm just asking
1982, I think I was back in New York, and I was working for WCBS-TV. So I was doing local TV news in New York City back then. So do you have a name that you're... Mm-hmm. Well, that wasn't me.
Well, no, it's not a problem. I do have another question for you. But I thought our paths may have crossed. I had been in Lebanon in 1982 as a guest of the... General Union of Palestinian Jurists, and I thought maybe you had done a story there on the struggle there in Lebanon, in Beirut.
Would that have been something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, not in Lebanon, but wow.
I'm sorry?
And what's your question? What's your question?
My question pertains to the boycott in Montgomery. I've just joined the webinar, so I'm not sure if you've already discussed this question, but Do you know Miss Claudette Colvin?
Yes. As a matter of fact, and if you'll read Daughter of the Boycott, there's a whole chapter on her. I went to visit her at her apartment in the Bronx. She's been fairly reclusive over the years and not really wanting to talk about, you know, they didn't have a boycott after I was arrested because I got pregnant, you know. And she was ostracized, and she actually left Montgomery because she found that she couldn't find employment. And she worked at a nursing home until fairly recently, and she has now moved back to Alabama, but to Birmingham, where she has some family. And she told me her whole story about what happened that day and being arrested and being in jail and, you know, how she really a little bit resents not getting she wants her own place in history because she feels like she made a difference. What she did counted, and she hasn't gotten the credit for it that she feels she deserves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm calling just for that purpose. I have also met and spoken with her in the Bronx. And okay. I went to her going, her return to, Alabama event in the Bronx when she moved back to Birmingham to stay near her sister there. Well, that's where she is now, in Birmingham. And we had a program here in Baltimore. I'm the president of the Baltimore Transit Equity Coalition. And she was featured in a conversation, an interview that we had with her, that I had with her on our what we called our Baltimore Transit Equity Solidarity Day. It featured her as one of the themes of Montgomery bus boycott. Because obviously it's still the most iconic example of black essential workers making a slam dunk victory against race-based transit policy. So we had her featured. But I'm asking another question. My question is,
Time. Go ahead.
Well, I'm asking, I can always talk to her offline.
No,
would
go
you
ahead.
Prefer that?
You got 1 minute.
Well, I can. Go ahead. We're trying to secure the recognition and respect that she deserves. And we are trying to find a good path through which to do that. And I'd like to, perhaps we can exchange discussion or email or messages offline, but we're trying to get through to, the general public. There's a lot of support for her. We've found a lot of interest in her issue, of course, and we want to follow through with that kind of respect that her story needs. The truth of it needs to be told. She was a 15-year-old young woman of rare courage, as you know. And
I agree.
What Montgomery, So what happened in Montgomery is something that often happens. She had all the characteristics of a leader. She was fearless. She was resolute. And she knew her rights. And she was not featured for a number of reasons, as you have mentioned one of them. But she did not get the same treatment.
Can I stop you for a second, Samuel? If you can leave your information with Michael and Maria, we can talk later. But I think you should probably go through her sister.
I have spoken with her sister.
Yeah, and you know what, Samuel? If you send us some information at BBS Radio, that's boyboysamradio.com, we'll make sure it gets forwarded to Miss Houston. Okay?
We're out of time now.
Thank you. And thank you, Ray Houston. We got to have you back because we only scratched the surface. And you know, we're coming up for a vote. There's a hearing on the 14th on DC statehood on markup. And then we hope in a vote on the floor on April 19th. And we really didn't get a chance to talk too much about that. So we're just going to have you back at another time. But we're so
grateful. Thank you.
Yes, that you were on our show.
Thank you. And keep moving forward with statehood.
Well, we're trying. And you know what? You've been an inspiration to us. And we end the show every week with a song. And so this one goes out to you and your dad and Uncle Frank and all those people who have paved the way for those of us that still work on civil rights issues to move forward. Here's John Legend with the song Glory. And thank you so much again, Karen Gray Houston.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.